This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you from Western Japan on the 27th of May 2011. It's still the 26th of May 2011 back in the United States, where I'm joined on the line today by Webster Griffin Tarpley, the writer, researcher, and geopolitical analyst behind Tarpley.net and World Crisis Radio on the GCN Radio Network. He's also the author of numerous books, including 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in the USA, a book that was particularly formative in my own process of coming to understand the false flag terror event that was 9/11. Webster Tarpley, it's a pleasure to finally have you on the program. Thank you for joining us today. All right. I understand today that you wanted to talk about philosophy and some of the philosophy that I was going into recently on the podcast, Philosophy of Freedom.
Yes. So, first of all, let me commend you for talking about this at all, because most of the time this is completely neglected, and these are the most important questions. So I welcome the chance to turn away from Libya and Pakistan and World War III and other related issues, the next false flag, to look at this, because without the right epistemology, it's just not possible to understand these things. I would say, first of all, the stress on liberty at the beginning, or freedom, risks being, I think, misunderstood. The real philosophical problems have to do today, in particular, how do we save human civilization as a whole? And within that, there is liberty, but above all, there's necessity. And the necessity is what gets very little attention. So we have the world now filled with radical subjectivists, especially in the Anglo-American world. They're radical subjectivists, they're relativists, and they're irrationalists. And they are essentially pitching the world into quite a bit of degradation. And because these civilizations are hegemonic, it means that the rest of the world tends to go along. The main things that are destroying the world today is this, what you could call Anglo-Saxon philosophy, empiricism, pragmatism, Darwinism, Malthusianism, the alternative to that, there is an alternative, and if you want to take it from the ancient world, it's the tradition, I guess, that I try to represent, which would be Plato, Machiavelli, Leibniz, and then the American system. In economics into the 19th and even into the 20th century. Certainly Aristotle has always been the philosopher of oligarchy par excellence. In other words, Aristotle is the dead hand of formalism, and he was created for this purpose. In other words, he's not just somebody who pops up. He is a kind of a emanation of the cult of Apollo at Delphi, and his doctrines are mainly designed to be a diversion away from Plato for people who don't know the difference or can't tell. In the ancient world, Aristotle was mainly known as a poisoner because of his mastery of herbs and poisons, and there's a pretty good tradition that he's the person who poisoned Alexander the Great. His apology for slavery, certainly you go into. I think also important for him at that time is the idea that the human being has no soul, that there's no divine faculty, or we might say in today's terms, a cognitive faculty or a faculty of reason. So even though he talks about reason, as soon as you say there's no soul in the terms that he does, it means that whatever reason there is not reason at all. It's at most some much, much inferior faculty. In the ancient world, most oligarchs, however, were not even followers of Aristotle. Stoicism was the leading thing in the ancient world. It's only then, later on, that Aristotle is brought in, primarily, I guess, in the wake of Luther. But the trick is that if you look at the medieval civilization of Europe, it's based on Christianity, and Christianity is essentially the merging of Hebrew monotheism with the Greek philosophical tradition of Plato. You see it very strongly in the Gospel according to St. John. Now, the problem of Aristotle and what goes with this is associated with Venice, and indeed the modern epistemological predicament is very, very heavily influenced by the Venetians, especially by somebody that I've studied. I've written a rather large book about Paolo Sarpi, S-A-R-P-I. Now, you're not going to find him in most of these Anglo-American histories of philosophy. Suffice it to say that he's the basis of both Hobbes and Locke. In particular, Locke is a direct plagiarist of Sarpi, as I have shown by translating one of Sarpi's shorter works, The Art of Thinking Well, into English. Locke is simply a guy who plagiarizes that. He pumps it up. He takes a 35-page paper and makes it into this 500-page essay on human understanding. But it's basically the same thing. The School of the Rialto in Venice is essentially in the 1200s and 1300s is the main locus of the Aristotelian rebirth in Central and Western Europe. The problem that the Venetians faced with Sarpi was that they wanted to keep Aristotelianism going, but there's such a mass of crazy theories about Aristotle and what he thinks about zoology and all the rest of this, that what Sarpi had to do was to find a way to dump most of the specific findings and conclusions and predicates of Aristotle and save, however, the method. And the method, of course, is empiricism. It is the idea of sense certainty, right? The old nihil in sensu quod non, nihil in intellectu quod non prius in sensu. It's not in your intellect unless it was in your senses first. And this, of course, is exactly wrong, because the whole idea of human reason is that there's this cognitive faculty, this concept-forming capability, which is really where the attention has to be focused, right? How do you refine that? How do you make that better? And essentially, when you look at Hobbes is simply a satellite of the Sarpi networks, in particular through Galileo. It's important to understand that Galileo is also a creature of Sarpi. Sarpi used Galileo to try to undermine the influence of Kepler, and really what Galileo represents is a kind of vulgarization or banalization of the things that you could already find in Kepler. Hobbes is, of course, this terrible, vicious, brutal philosopher of dictatorship. This was also personally for Hobbes a way to try to sell himself to Cromwell, was somebody that the Venetians had promoted in order to do maximum wreckage in the old traditions of England. So the war of all against all. It's also important to see that with Hobbes, equally important is that you have to be against the Vatican and the Pope at all times, which again is a typical theme of the Venetians, because this is where they stand in terms of the power politics of Italy. So that's essentially Hobbes, right? This is the philosophy of any totalitarian, brutal dictatorship. The guy's profoundly reactionary in every conceivable way. Now, when you get Locke, it's a little bit more, it's somewhat more refined. Now, what Locke is essentially, this is part of a network of oligarchs, right? This is the time of the cabal, right? Of this clique of oligarchs who were very important in the runnings of the Restoration, essentially, in England. But the Revolution of 1688 is what? It's the imposition of the Anglo-Dutch monarchy on England, and with the help of Locke's patron, this Shaftesbury, he's essentially an apologist for that. So unfortunately, a lot of the people who write the American Constitution are very opportunistic, and they say, yeah, we can do this, we can have the American Revolution because Locke already did it. He did it in the sense that he's trying to justify this takeover of England by this Anglo-Dutch faction. People who think that Locke has anything to do with political freedom should focus on this, I think. At a certain point, Locke was invited to do a constitution for the state of South Carolina. And he proposed a constitution, and that the centerpiece of this was the reimposition of hereditary serfdom. He calls it leetmen, but it means hereditary serfdom, that is quasi slavery, on people in the state of South Carolina. You can see he goes right back to Aristotle on this stuff. As I've shown in my writings, Newton, the fame of Newton as opposed to Leibniz is decisively established, but with the help of Antonio Conti, Conti, a Venetian nobleman of the period. And later on, Malthus is another plagiarist. He's like Locke, but in this case, Malthus is plagiarizing from the Venetian original Gian Maria Ortes. So what you've got today, when you look at empiricism, pragmatism, the schools of thought that are responsible for the ruin of our world, this is, you could call it the Anglo-Venetian tendency in modern thought. And that, of course, would include monetarism, right? These people like Bentham or David Ricardo, Herbert Spencer, Charles Darwin. These are all simply continuations of that. And I think that's some idea. Now, I notice you're interested in Rousseau and Hobbes. Essentially, this is simply taking the state of nature, right? This idea that there's the war of all against all, right? The law of the jungle. And you have two sides, right? Hobbes says, this is the way it is. This is his idea of natural law. That's the way things are. And Rousseau, of course, says, no, this was paradise, right? That the problem was the imposition of government and property and so forth is the real place where we went wrong. We were better off when we were in the state of nature. So once you believe in the state of nature as somehow a category that's of any use at all in analyzing human affairs, it really doesn't matter whether you negate it the way Hobbes does. I mean, he says it's bad, it's nasty, brutish, and short, but this is the way it is. Or like Rousseau, you can say it's wonderful. I would say Rousseau is probably the most influential philosopher today, simply because he is the philosopher of rejecting civilization. In other words, that civilization is all a terrible mistake. And this would be especially the ecologists, the Malthusians, the Greenies, right, the global warming people, all of them who say terrible technology, science, progress, industry, these are all bad. Got to go back to the cavemen, right? The idea that primitive people are repositories of wisdom and that civilized people are corrupted, right? That's pure Rousseau. It's also important to see that Rousseau is the basis of Marx, because what does Marx really say? He says that the people who are the most rejected by society, the most wretched, the most outcast, the people who have no property, no education, no hope, no rights, the proletariat, they are somehow going to take it over and become the repository of some kind of a new world. And it's not by coincidence that Marx is also a British agent. So you don't get around doing an analysis of who these people actually were. Now, in terms of a positive thing, right? You wanted to talk about liberty, right? And freedom.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, in this case, look. The source of freedom is Plato's Republic, and the idea here is in particular this analysis of oligarchy, tyranny, and mob rule. And the finding with Plato, of course, is that none of these by itself can work. Tyranny is going to be bad. Oligarchy is a constitution full of many evils. That's plutocracy. That's pretty much what we have today. And then the mob, which you can also see we have in other parts in various combinations going on today. So Plato's finding is simply that none of these is going to be adequate, that you have to, he has a kind of an elegant way to suggest where the solution lies, right, which is the idea of a philosopher king. In other words, somebody who somehow has understood all this and realizes that without people who are willing to do what is necessary rather than act according to the mentality of the oligarch, the tyrant, or the mob, you're not going to have civilization. So you've got to find people who are willing to do this, and it takes some sacrifices and some special effort. Now, the form in which we have our government today here in the U.S. is essentially based on Machiavelli, not Locke. And it's based on Machiavelli's looking back at Greek and Roman history in particular in his discourses. And he does this with the help also of the Greek historian of the Roman era, Polybius. And it's again this idea of how do you somehow solve this problem that none of the simple forms, not tyranny, not oligarchy, not the mob, can work. What do you do? And the finding is he focuses on this idea of the Roman institution of the tribunes of the people. In other words, a democratic corrective against oligarchy. And many historians note that without the tribunes of the people, Rome is just another oligarchy like so many others. But that it's the tribunes of the people that, in other words, you build the conflict of these groups into the form of government. And that's essentially what Machiavelli has figured out, and which he puts forward then in the discourses. And this is ontology now. This is something very basic about humanity. As long as humanity exists, it's going to exist in the form of individuals. And they will be either the one, right, somebody who's really powerful all by himself, a dictator, or the head of a, you know, a neo-feudal power center. Could be an oligarchy, right? Could be a larger or smaller group of powerful people, or it could be a mob, or it could be the generality. So what do you do? You're always going to deal with this. It doesn't do any good to say, I'm going to wipe out oligarchy, because you can't. And you can't wipe out the tendency towards tyranny, nor can you wipe out the possibility that there might be a mob. What you can do is to build these into the form of government. In other words, to say, let's channel these principles into a constitutional form of government where they can fight it out peacefully, because that's the big thing, to avoid civil war, which anybody can see is the worst of all possible outcomes, which is what the U.S. and the British are, of course, spreading across the world today. And this is done then by John Adams. The Constitution of the State of Massachusetts, written by John Adams with Machiavelli's discourses in mind, is, of course, then the model of the three branches of the federal government. Adams is often neglected, right? People want to write about Madison and people like this, fine. But the main ideas of the Constitution were really established before the Constitutional Convention by John Adams through the Massachusetts Constitution. So here we have the idea of an executive, a legislative, a judiciary. You look at the federal constitution that comes out of it. The president, he embodies this monarchical or sometimes tyrannical principle. The judiciary and the Senate are the oligarch parts, and then the House of Representatives, supposedly the democratic part, the part where the mob can be heard. Now, the reason this government is going bad is because all of them are being oligarchized, right? The president is being weakened. We have traditionally very weak presidents in the last several decades, really since the anti-Roosevelt backlash and the two-term limit. And the House of Representatives is also oligarchical in the sense that it costs almost as much to get a seat in the House as it does in the Senate. That's why the system is breaking down, and you've got to bear that in mind if you're thinking about any reforms. The other problem we have, of course, is the growth of this what can we call it? Libertarianism. I think if you saw that Republican debate the other night, when you see somebody like Ron Paul get up there and say he wants the legalization of marijuana, heroin, and prostitution, and he regards that as a basis for running for president of the United States, I think you can see that civilization is in very, very grave danger, and that there's got to be some assertion of what I would call natural law, right, which is what a conservative would stand for, the idea that you're not simply free to turn liberty into license and say, I can do what I want because I want to, as Ron Paul said, liberty across the board. No, that will not do. The whole point of liberty was it was supposed to be liberty to do what is just, to do what is necessary, and in a broader sense, liberty is liberty to do what's going to lead to social progress, because if it doesn't, the civilization will collapse. In other words, that aspect of necessity that I mentioned at the beginning is always there. In other words, if a society does not realize scientific, technological, industrial, agricultural progress, it will collapse. And this is a rule that all have faced, and most have not faced it successfully, right? You can look up Toynbee or Oswald Spengler or whoever you want, and you'll see all the different forms of civilization that have collapsed, right? And that's where we're headed to. But the answer, therefore, is you've got to realize progress. Another word for maybe more modern term for natural law would be ontology of social or societal existence. I guess that's what I would rather call it myself. But for a lot of people, God's law does the idea. And if you say we want the legalization of heroin, marijuana, and prostitution, then that can't be God's law, can it? So and it's simply not compatible. You were puzzling about slavery there in your lecture. Slavery is inadmissible because it's a money loser. It has never been profitable to have slavery compared to what you could do if you took those same people, educated them, invested in some machinery and some capital inputs. You can do much better in economic terms. But it violates also the fundamental law that the dialectic of the individual and the society is that the progress of the society has to be mediated through the individual. In other words, it's in particular, individual creative actions, scientific discoveries, or acts of teaching, or new ideas in general, is the way that the society is going to progress. In other words, human society would have collapsed long ago if we hadn't had science, technology, and realized that in the form of industry. And that's where the individual comes in. And that, of course, it takes a very broad cultural basis to be able to have that. So that is why I would say, yes, obviously you want to look for political freedom of the individual, but not that you have this sort of, individualistic method, right? That you think that the individual is prior to society. It's not true. Humanity was social before it became human, right? As far as we can tell from the available, archaeology and anthropology. So those were some of my responses to that last lecture. The other thing I would say is you've got to realize that the academic profession of philosophy is totally corrupt. I have my PhD in history, and one of my projects is to reassert the domination of historians over the history of philosophy, because the philosophers are incapable. They just can't do it. Most of them today are either neocons or they're wild, right? They're either the neocons, meaning that they're the cult of Apollo, or they're some crazy postmodern continental philosophy, Derrida, whatever, Frankfurt School, meaning that they're the cult of Dionysio. So it's time to get the history of philosophy back into history, because the philosophers have mucked it up in the past couple of hundred years.
Well, that was quite a sweeping series of that was quite a large overview. So thank you for all of that. I must say that I think I have problems with some of the ways that some of the things have been characterized. So let's go back towards the point of Aristotelian epistemology versus Platonic, and talking obviously about the idea of the empiricism that grew out of Aristotle's philosophy versus the Platonic idealism, I suppose. But looking at how that plays into a political system, I'm not sure how we can turn away from the oligarchicalism that has been often used and justified through Aristotle's writings and turn towards Plato's Republic, which seems to me to be a formalization of the aristocratic ideal and also of eugenics.
Yeah, but only if you take it literally, and this is exactly what you cannot do. In other words, you cannot give an Aristotelian reading of Plato. He's trying to tell you what are the problems that civilization would face. The philosopher king, right? There will be no salvation for humanity until there are philosopher kings. Well, you can see what he's getting at. Not that you're literally going to have the dictatorship of the philosopher kings. But look at practice. See, one of the traditions of people who are trying to do good in the world, and that's Plato, right? We're talking about the form of the good, and it floats above the horizon of historical change. You can see the same thing in Leibniz, right? Plato did it with Dionysios of Syracuse, the tyrant. Leibniz did it with Peter the Great. You try to influence these people, and what you find is that the tyrant is the one that you can influence, whereas the oligarchy you almost never can, because there's so many you'd have to convince, and if you convince one of them, then you get others against you. Whereas with the tyrant, there is a certain chance that you can get something done. So they try to do it. The way to look at this is not so much inside the texts, but look at the tradition. The positive elements of the Italian Renaissance are all Platonic. Petrarch, Dante. Dante is a bit complicated because he has to pay lip service to Aristotle because of the current factional situation. But if you look at his division, paradise, purgatory, and inferno, what is that? That is the broken line of book 7 of Plato's Republic, where you're starting from the lowest level in the inferno, which is sense certainty and the realm of opinion and rage. The step up is the realm of purgatory, which is now the understanding, or Verstand, right? Mathematical reasoning and things like this. And then the highest of the three human faculties would then be reason, which is the area, and if you read Dante, it's the area of scientific discovery and questions of astronomy, theology, and the other sciences that were available. Petrarch, look at Petrarch's De sui ipsius et multorum ignorantia, the ignorance of Aristotle and of his friends in Venice. And he wrote this after his clash with these people. So this is the founder of modern European poetry and quite a political operative in his own right. And you can go through this. You can go through this, I think, as a pretty good historical rule. Aristotle is the philosopher of the oligarchs, and this would include the Jesuits, most emphatically. The Jesuits in the post-Luther backlash are the exponents of oligarchy and oppression, and they are the ones who they essentially merge Aristotle into the Roman Catholic Church in a way that would have been impossible to do before this. In other words, there's a historical correlation between Aristotle on the one side and oligarchical evil on the other. And it's this no soul question, as well as the slavery question, that play the central role. Whereas the Italian Renaissance, in a general way, is animated by a Platonic approach.
All right, well, I think we've bitten off much more than we could possibly chew in just this half-hour conversation, and there's plenty more that I'd like to get into.
All right, let me just suggest a way to proceed then. For people who want to know more, if you look at my website, tarpley.net, over the years, right, it goes back 20 years now at least, I've done a series of things about, it's called Against Oligarchy, and the printed book edition of this is long overdue. But if you look on my website, you can go to the Against Oligarchy part, and you'll see these essays. And it's essentially the question of, starts with the ancient world, right, the question of the reforms of the Gracchi and what this all meant. But it's in particular the role of the Venetians in the Middle Ages, the role then of the British with the Hobbes and Locke and Hume and so forth, and then into the modern time with the continuation of that British tradition. In other words, why Bentham, Darwin, Malthus, why these people are bankrupt, why Newton was a charlatan, and so forth. And it concludes then with the American system of political economy, which is philosophically based, and this would then be Alexander Hamilton, Friedrich List, Henry Carey, Henry Clay, into the New Deal, and into the tradition that I try to represent today. So you can go back and look at this stuff, and you can see then the hollowness of these academic lecturers, right, they're talking about Locke and Hobbes as characters in a fairy tale. And what they'll never do is to situate these writings in a concrete historical context. What were they actually aiming at the time, which I think is absolutely indispensable. In other words, you need the ad hominem part to understand what's going on. The other big thing, I guess, in my writings is the idea that Luther, Calvin, and Henry VIII, right, the three heroes of the Protestant Reformation, each in his own way, is a Venetian asset, and each of their so-called religious reforms is actually dictated by the needs of Venetian geopolitics. In other words, the need of the Venetians to foment religious warfare elsewhere, to play other countries and parts of Europe against each other. This is what Luther represents, and Calvin, and Henry VIII.
Okay, very interesting, and I certainly hope people will take a look into that on your website, as I will myself, indeed. So I would be happy to have you on in the future for an hour or even longer if you had time to go more in-depth into this.
Sure, we could cut it down a little bit to maybe carve out a topic, but
well,
I would also urge you got to take this stuff to heart. The philosophers, it is one of the most corrupt of all disciplines these days, and it's essentially, it has died out, right? Because the political ones are neocons, and the other ones are generally given over to this. If it's not Derrida and the deconstructionists, then it's going to be Habermas and the Frankfurt School. This has gotten to be, it's reached the point of absolute breakdown. I mean, there's not much left. They're also Marxists, of course, right? And they're you know, very, very weak, but they're as bankrupt as the next.
Well, I would be interested in carving out some territory about individualism versus society, and because I think I have some points of disagreement there, but I'd like to flesh them out with you, and it's healthy and good to have.
This is the problem of the modern libertarianism. In other words, essentially what it in very crude terms, modern libertarianism equals the reactionaries of the 1930s who hated Roosevelt and loved Hitler, or they loved Mussolini, and some of them loved Hitler too, quite a few. You add essentially marijuana to that, and you get a libertarian, and it's a completely concocted point of view. We can see it in the fact that the Cato Institute, which is the main center for this stuff, was funded by these Koch brothers, right? The so-called Koch brothers, right? The two fascist billionaires there from New York, right? The richest people in Babylon, in the city of New York, and they are the great libertarians. So at that point, you've got to see this is a sham, right? This is a market of dupes of colossal proportions, and the impact of libertarianism on U.S. politics has been a disaster.
Interesting. Well, personally, I hate Mussolini and Roosevelt, so perhaps we can get into that point of disagreement as well. But
no,
okay.
No basis for hating Roosevelt.
Well, we'll certainly get into that in our next conversation. Webster Tarpley, I know you're a busy man. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us today.
See you soon.
Okay.